It's Wednesday, September 1st, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, 16 years to the day after Katrina, Ida made landfall Sunday. We're going to talk about the storm, the coverage, and the people at the center of both.
Your name has been battered about on the internet, but you've never been officially publicly identified. Do you want to tell us who you are?
My name is Michael Byrd. I'm a lieutenant for the United States Capitol Police.
NBC's Lester Holt sits down for the first interview with the Capitol Police officer who shot and killed Ashley Babbitt on January 6th. We'll talk about that interview. And we will remember one of America's most beloved fictional news executives, the man who played television's Lou Grant. There's a lot more that hopefully we're going to get to before our time is up today, but we're going to start back down in Louisiana, where hundreds of thousands are still without power and are trying to start to pick up the pieces Hurricane Ida had left behind. There are a few different angles to the story that I want to explore with both of you today, starting with the quality of the coverage that you saw this weekend and what you've seen in the time since.
Well, I think the quality has been pretty well. It's I think that there's definitely a lot of human stories in the coverage that you've seen, but it's also they've gone to great lengths to try to differentiate this storm from Katrina, which happened 16 years ago to the day. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they really kept pointing out was that whereas Katrina caused a lot of damage because of storm surge, this storm, Ida, caused a lot of damage both by mostly by wind, but also by storm surge. But it was really the wind that sort of done the most damage. And the fact that it was widespread as well, caused a lot of issues. So I think the coverage has gone out of its way to make those points and to show that the differences in the storm. Yeah. The other thing I think that they've done a good job of is showing just how prepared the area was for this in terms of here are the things we're going to do once the storm has moved through. That was not the case during Katrina. You didn't see a lot of that because number one, the news organizations are scrambling all around trying to figure out where to go. And then number two, the government itself, both at the local, state, and at the national level, wasn't as prepared as they were this time.
So that is one thing, that as time has passed, a level of preparedness and how a storm, which may have come with some of packing the same kind of punch, which is very cliche, but a storm of the same type of a magnitude, really people were able to find safety in different ways or to more seriously heed that call for evacuation to higher ground and resources to be deployed and for people to understand what those were going to be for those who maybe didn't have the means to do so.
Right, right. I think the other difference too here is that there are fewer people in that region.
Because a lot
now,
of people didn't return.
Because a lot of people didn't
Katrina.
Return. And so there are fewer people in that region now than there were during Katrina.
Well, and yeah. I think that'll be an interesting thing to see how much more that region becomes depopulated. I think one thing that is the same about these two storms is the long tail. The terrible damage of Katrina was not the day of the storm itself, but afterwards when the levees broke. Here, I think there's a danger of a similar kind of catastrophe because the transmission lines are out. And with the heat the way it is now and people not having power, I think that could be really dangerous. And that's why you're seeing a lot of the local officials using the media to get the message across that people shouldn't come back. But I think the other thing is how many more storms like this will there be? And how much are we going to start to see a real population shift because of climate change? And I think that's where I'm seeing some really interesting conversations in some of the media, is because this is not happening in a vacuum. There have been a bunch of these big storms, not just in the United States, but across the world. And it's happening at the same time as this massive wildfire that is threatening Lake Tahoe. So I think finally the message may be getting across about climate change, and you're starting to see that more widely in the media than it used
to be. Yeah, you're seeing it in the coverage. I mean, they're literally, I mean, the reporters are doing a very effective job of linking the storms, the fires to climate change. And previously, it sort of just covered the
event.
It was
a weather story. It was a weather story. As opposed to a larger national story with impact.
International.
International story with impact having to do with also the effect that we as human beings have on creating these storms as they happen.
Right. I mean, Kathy brought up a good point. Yeah. I mean, the fact that the transmission line. So the fact that they learned from Katrina that you needed to have very strong and very high levees to deal with the storm surge. What they didn't take into account in this storm is the high winds that knocked out the transmission lines. And you can't bury those lines because most of the land in that area is below sea level. So you can't bury it, which would have taken care of that problem. So now they're going to come back and say, okay, how do we deal with a storm that produces heavy wind that could knock out the power transmission lines that will pretty much cripple the entire part of the state?
So for all of the really good reporting that there has been there was at least one moment that the staff of the Tegna station, WWL in New Orleans, probably wishes it could take back.
Look at this. My goodness. Wait a second. I don't know exactly where this is. We showed you a little bit of video earlier out of New Orleans East that possibly showed, or actually that did show, a tornado that happened not this year. This was about 4 years ago. We all know there was an EF3 tornado that hit New Orleans East 4 years ago. We showed you that video mistakenly with the other weather video that we have, so we want to issue an apology to you.
So they tried really hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube on that one. And in a breaking news event like this one, journalists can become really vulnerable to that bad actor who wants to have something go viral from their Twitter account, like what happened here. And somebody takes old video from an old event. And journalists trying so hard to be first instead of being right.
Speed kills.
Take that video, they put it on the air without verifying it or looking it up. What should have happened, Kathy, in a situation like this in that newsroom?
Well, I think, you know, we've certainly seen and we've talked on this show about the ways in which citizen journalists make real contributions. We've talked about one winning a Pulitzer in the for the George Floyd video. Mm-hmm. But it is true, as you said, Amy, there are a lot of people who are kind of voyeuristic. They're out there. They want to be on the news. And so what we've learned in newsrooms is that you cannot assume that the video is
new.
Legit or new, and so you need to verify it. And there are organizations that have developed methods for doing this. Bellingcat, the UK-based organization, First Draft News
is the one that we use as the basis for courses we teach here.
Yes.
In their verification
process. And they are excellent, but it takes time.
It does.
You have to actually go and examine the video, look at landmarks, figure out where this came from. I would say the bottom line is, if you're in a newsroom and you're on deadline and you can't talk to the person who produced that video, don't use it.
No, that's absolutely
I would agree
right.
with that 100%. One of the things I have been trained by First Draft personally, and I know that you participated in one of their sessions as well. And one of the things Claire Wardle does in the workflow she puts forward is that you start by determining if content is new, what the provenance of it is. So where did it come from? Who is the person who posted it? What's the background of that person? What's their motivation for posting it? What's their location? And then, if possible, contact them to get more information. And it's interesting because there's an example that I use of her verifying something like this. And this is an expert, one of the world's foremost experts, and it takes her 8 minutes to go through and formally verify content that would be publishable.
Yeah, but someone, you know, I'm thinking someone who's working, producing that or directing that, the first thing I should go like, where did this come from?
Exactly. And that and is that whole, like,
that
once you know that it's new, right? Because if you find out that it is video that you've done a reverse image search on and know that it's appeared 72 times on the internet previously, why even bother to ask that question of who posted it?
Right.
And then begin to find that out and ask that question before you go any further.
Yeah.
So it seems this way every hurricane season when we have this conversation where the journalists themselves end up becoming a part of the story too. Jim Cantore was in the streets of New Orleans donning a batting helmet. That was how he chose to keep safe on the Weather Channel. And during Meet the Press, Al Roker got pummeled by a wall of water. Twitter had a heyday with that, saying that NBC shouldn't be sending a man of Roker's age, almost 70, out into a storm this strong, that it just was not a safe thing to do. So here's Roker catching up later in the day with MSNBC's Jonathan Capehart.
Yeah. At a certain point, it's going to come where the big water hits you. How long?
It's one of these things, and folks on Twitter have been, well, first of all, why is NBC putting him out there? I volunteered to come out here. This is what I do. I've done this for 40 years. Our crews, and we all make sure we're safe. We're not going to do something that's going to put ourselves at harm's way. Right. As much as I love the weather and I love NBC, I'm not going to risk my life for it. Secondly, a number of people, well, he's too old to be doing this. Well, hey, guess what? Screw you, okay? Try to keep up. Keep up, okay?
Okay, so I guess there's part of me that is somewhat relieved to see and hear both of you laughing at that. I guess you hadn't watched it before now to have that reaction, so that's good too. I kind of want to say to the haters too, like, he's out there providing a public service for you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if he volunteers to go out there, then I don't have a problem with it. But, I mean, I watched this and I've watched it my entire career. I've actually done it. I've covered hurricanes, I've covered tornadoes, I've covered floods, I've done it, I've done all that. And I have, you know, I look at it and I sort of go back in my own Wayback Machine and go like, what was I thinking when I was standing out there in waist deep water trying to get to someone to get their story? And it goes back to what you just said. You're trying to give the public a sense as to what is actually going on and how people are trying to survive in the midst of a very dangerous situation. And that's the job. That's the job of a journalist. So, I mean, I understand what he's saying. But sometimes you kind of go back and forth as to why are they doing it, and then for someone who did it, you kind of go like, okay, yeah, I get it.
I vividly remember myself and a photographer from the Houston Post driving across the causeway towards the Outer Banks when Gloria was about to hit and everybody was coming the other way. So
that's the real one, when everybody's leaving and you're going
and you're going the other way. That is the classic life of a reporter. But I will also say we had this very interesting conversation in my reporting class here yesterday, and our chief meteorologist, KOMU's Kenton Jewicki, was there, and one of the Missourian editors was in the room and asked him exactly that question. Is that really necessary? And he made a really good point. He said, you know, we go out there, it the visuals mean something to people.
It tells them something. Those people who evacuated and need to know, it's not time to go home yet.
Exactly. So he felt that there's a real public service element of that. And obviously, I think what's important for listeners and viewers to know is that nobody forces anyone to do this. You can always opt out. And so Al Roker's a weather geek. He wanted to be out there in it.
Yeah. Well, so there's another clip that you can see by watching our Lynx blog. The quality of the audio wasn't strong enough to run it here on the program with us, but NBC's Shaquille Brewster was accosted by an angry man who happened to be white. This reporter is black. This man drove up, came up to him inches from his face, and started shouting at him to report accurately. And it was a really tense moment. The director at NBC cut away from Brewster very quickly to take it off the air. Craig Melvin, the anchor, kind of kept adding to it and bringing more anxiety into that moment.
Yeah, I think that the anchor could have sort of diffused the moment there. But again, I think this goes back to something we've talked about for a while here, is there's this sort of antagonistic environment when it comes to journalists, reporters, in particular reporters and journalists of color, and those who feel as if, you know, who have bought into this thing that the media is somehow not being accurate and authentic in the way in which they report stories, and they physically go after them whenever they encounter them, and we're seeing more and more of this, and it's really dangerous.
Well, yeah, we've had it happen with our students, even again this summer. Second time, student was spat at. While reporting.
There were charges brought against this man that I read about this morning, which also speaks to kind of some of those pushes on the national level to have some
accountability
and laws written around protecting journalists. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment that we really should recognize and honor the journalists who live and work in the state of Louisiana and Mississippi who took time away from their homes, their families, their loved ones, again, to tell that story, to do that public
absolutely.
Service.
No, absolutely. I mean, and Kathy, you would know this, having gone and covered those storms as well, is that you spend most of your time, you're working. I mean, when that storm hits, you're working the entire time. I mean, you're on 24/7, and you may not
have a home to go home to when the shift is over.
Absolutely. And you don't know, you know that your family, at least you try to make sure that your family is safe, but oftentimes you lose communication and you may not have it for a while. And so it's really important to understand that that's the case. I mean, I had several former students who covered Katrina, and when I still talk to them to this day, that was the one thing that they really bring back, is that, you know, they literally didn't have any contact with their family for weeks while trying to cover that story.
Okay. Friday night, NBC News aired its exclusive interview with Lieutenant Michael Byrd, the Capitol police officer who fired the shot during the January 6th insurrection that killed Ashley Babbitt. Since that time, Byrd has been in hiding since a bunch of right-wing websites revealed his name earlier this year. And he's been called out by Tucker Carlson, by Laura Ingraham, and even former President Trump had made verbal attacks against him. Well, now the time had come, according to his attorney, for him to speak out. And he chose NBC's Lester Holt as the journalist he wanted to talk to.
Former President Trump has talked about you and this incident. He says she was murdered. What does it feel like to hear that from a former president?
Well, it's disheartening. If he was in the room or anywhere and I'm responsible for him, I was prepared to do the same thing for him and his family.
Would you have his back today if you were so assigned?
I sure would, because it's my job.
As I said, your name has been on the internet for some time in an unofficial way. A lot of rumors, a lot of accusations, one of which is that you had some sort of political motive. You were a political operative.
I do my job for Republican, for Democrat, for white, for black, red, blue, green.
A few years ago, you were investigated for leaving your service weapon in a bathroom.
Yes.
And that's been brought up by those who are questioning your competency.
Yeah.
Do you want to respond to that?
Sure. It was a terrible mistake. I acknowledged it. I owned up to it. I accepted the responsibility. I was penalized for it. And I moved on.
So when Byrd agreed to do this interview and chose Lester Holt as the person to give the interview to, one of the reasons, according to his attorney in a conversation that the attorney had with Richard Prince of Journalism's, said that he chose Lester Holt because of his credibility and because he felt he had a better opportunity for fairness and that he had that trust in Lester Holt because of his race. And you mentioned that just a minute ago.
Yeah, I mean, that had a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you've been attacked the way in which he has, when you've had to go into hiding, and then you decide that you're going to come out publicly, you want to talk with someone that you trust, someone that you feel is going to tell your story or allow you to tell your story. And that was the case here. And I think Lester Holt did a very effective job of allowing him to tell his story and bringing up a lot of the issues that some in the right wing media have brought up, such as him leaving his service weapon in the restroom, mm-hmm. whether or not he would have done the same thing had it been President Trump on the other side.
There were hard questions there.
Yeah, those are very hard questions.
Yeah, this was not a cream puff interview.
Yeah.
I have to say that I totally understand why he did what he did, because the
Bird
policeman.
Okay. I just
choosing,
wanted to get the...
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry. Choosing to speak to Lester Holt and choosing to do so because of his race, because let's face it, some of this policeman's critics have racialized this debate and they have racialized the attacks on him, and the attack on the journalist we mentioned earlier mm-hmm. was a racialized attack. That's why it was so outrageous. I can kind of understand why the anchor wouldn't let it go. And so, as Ernest said, I mean, these attacks on anybody are terrible. But then to turn it into a genderized, racialized attack is really going back to an era that I hope we're not going to return to. And I would put it on the people... the Fox News anchors, who are white, the other right-wing media attacking this guy.
Who are also white.
Who are also white. And let's just face it, you know, I don't blame him one bit. They've turned it into a racial thing, and I think he should have done what he did.
Okay. For the second week in a row, I want to talk about something that's going on at the Kansas City Star. The Star and its owner, McClatchy, has asked a Johnston County, Kansas judge to force the city of Overland Park to pay the city's legal bills. Because, you see, last year, the paper sued Overland Park, seeking the release of records related to the police killing of a 17-year-old boy in 2018. Now, Kathy, this is a pretty complicated case here. The Star was accusing Overland Park of cover-ups in severance packages offered to the police officer in that shooting, and claimed those should have been public records and had to sue to get them.
Yeah, well, they should have been public records. I mean, because it's public money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the simple fact, is that if you're spending my tax dollars, I have a right to know how you're spending that. And so the newspapers aren't asking for this for their own benefit. They want to let the taxpayers know, is the money being spent properly or not? Do they approve of the way this money is being spent? So I think the Star was absolutely within its rights. That's what a news organization should do. And unfortunately, all too few of them have enough money to keep doing that these days.
Well,
so
and I
good
think that's
them.
Kind of the point here, too, of saying, like, okay, we want you to pay our legal fees, too, because you should have turned that over in the
exactly.
first place.
No,
we shouldn't have had you
absolutely.
Done this.
I mean, they made a decision to enter into a severance agreement with this police officer before the case was adjudicated, mm-hmm. and not to expect that a news organization was going to ask, okay, how did that happen? Why did that happen? And can we see the records related to that? Come on, it's public record.
Okay.
Turn it over.
So the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is finding itself back in a courtroom as well, only in their case, they're the defendant. One of its former reporters is suing for discrimination after she was one of two black journalists who were pulled from covering protests following the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Well, last week, a judge said the case could go forward, but is giving the paper a chance to kind of re-argue its defense that it was exercising its First Amendment rights when not assigning those two reporters to cover that story.
Yeah, but I think the key thing here is that the judge did not dismiss the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what the newspaper wanted. The newspaper wanted to just get off scot-free. We were well within our rights as a private employer, et cetera. And by not dismissing the case, I think that the paper coming back and saying, oh, we're going to have an argument, we're going to get to re-argue, is kind of a fig leaf. But to me, I think that's a real defeat, and that this case is going forward. And that means the meter starts running for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and they should be paying
well,
some
yeah,
money.
Well, yeah, and to try to use the First Amendment in a personnel case
right,
and actually think that that's going to fly, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You can't turn around and say, well, we fired them because we felt like they violated our First Amendment rights. And I'm like, wait a minute, but they work for you.
Okay, so we are people who, you know, the First Amendment is key to everything we do every day. Talk for a minute, Ernest, about how it's kind of a flimsy argument for people who may not be as familiar with it.
Well, it's a flimsy argument because they're saying that the words that she used or what she said in her own Twitter account somehow infringed upon the First Amendment rights of the newspaper to then turn around and report on that story, or for her to be part of the newspaper to report on that story. Thus, we are going to sever her employment. And come on, that's flimsy, as Kathy said, and now you're going to have to come up with another excuse as to why you fired her.
Well, they'll have the opportunity to do that and perhaps fall flat a second time.
Yeah.
Before we go, I've got to play it. One of the most iconic moments in 1970s television.
Mr. Grant, I will, but it does seem that you've been asking a lot of very personal questions that don't have a thing to do with my qualifications for this job.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well,
I hate spunk.
That, of course, was Ed Asner as Lou Grant talking to Mary Tyler Moore's character, Mary Richards. Asner played the gruff news director at WJM-TV and then got his own spinoff where he worked as the city editor at the fictional Los Angeles Tribune. He was a multi-platform journalist decades ahead of his time. He died Sunday at his Los Angeles home at the age of 91. You know, Ernest, one of the things that you and I have been talking about just as a matter of coincidence the past couple of weeks is like these pop culture moments that seem to transcend generations. To us, he's Lou Grant,
yeah,
right? But to your kids, your grandchildren, he's going to be Carl from Up.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I watched that movie with some of my cousins, and yeah. I'm like, wow, that, you know, that's...
You made it past the first 15 minutes because like, that was so crushing.
That's Lou Grant, right? Lou Grant has been that movie, yeah. Right?
I mean, but to me, I remember, so it's this, you know, some people like the Lou Grant in Mary Tyler Moore show. And some people like Lou Grant in his own spinoff. I liked the one in the spinoff because that...
Well, you're the newspaper guy.
Because I'm the newspaper guy. But even more so than that, yeah, it went from a sitcom to a serious show. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, that's unusual. You don't usually see a sitcom character wind up doing a serious drama. And that show dealt with real issues that journalists dealt with at the time in ways that you would find hard to see now. I'm not sure whether or not that kind of drama could actually make it on network television.
Well, I don't
right
know
now
that most dramas from that era could make it on network television.
But he was just typecast to be the gruff city editor.
Yeah.
He was.
We've all had editors like that.
Yeah, I had
like
one
that
like that, yeah.
Maybe I'm one of them now.
Well, I didn't know. Right, well, you know, even go back. So Ernest talked about watching him as the gruff city editor. Is the woman with spunk? Did you see your editors too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've been put down in pretty much that same way. So, I mean, I think he captured an ethos that maybe doesn't exist anymore, but it's certainly, and I think it's a time when the media was not despised, was not hated. In fact, there was a great deal of affection for the media, and I hope that time comes back again.
Yeah. Okay, well, we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That is under the Programs and Podcast tabs at kbia.org. You can also catch us wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. I'd like to thank RJ Ice, Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you when we're back in 2 weeks.